Hey, Dad.
Hey, Logan.
What do you get when Chuck Norris studies Catholicism in a monastery?
Just a wacky conservative Christian, I would say.
A nunchuck.
Oh my God. I freaking can't even.
Oh, good point.
You're listening to The Wayward Willis with John and Logan, where two atheists discuss religion, culture, and maybe some politics. If you're offended by blasphemy, profanity, or you hate fun, this podcast may not be right for you. And now, on to the show.
Hey, you.
It's us.
The ugliest of all the ducklings.
Speak for yourself. This is your call to prayer with your host, John.
And I'm Logan, a guy who takes a hard stance against Thanksgiving stuffing.
I spent a lot of time in a cave this week and emerged more literate and authoritative than when I went in. We're talking about Islam.
So, what even is Islam?
Well, the dictionary defines Islam as the religion of the Muslims, a monotheistic faith regarded as revealed through Muhammad as the prophet of Allah. As we all know, monotheistic means a single god, and in this case, we're talking about the god of Abraham, Allah, not to be confused with Yahweh or Jehovah, who are the god of Abraham.
Ah, yes, thanks for clearing that one up.
No, they're the same thing! And, much like the different sects of Christianity have different Jesuses, all three Abrahamic religions worship the same god, but different gods. But the same. Totally not confusing. You're welcome.
My brain cells just got a bit of a workout.
The root word of Islam would be salam, which means peace. Also the root word of salami, which is like, give me a piece of that salami, right?
I hate you.
This, in large part, is why you hear Islam referred to as the religion of peace. It's easy. You don't even have to get creative with the word to come up with that. And if a literal reading of the religion's name is where we stopped, then we could all agree that Islam is the religion of peace, and everyone practicing it is a generous, meek, sociable person.
Woo! That's a wrap, everybody. Pack it up. Let's get out of here.
Not so fast. We always find out that when people are involved in a good idea, it gets tweaked, interpreted, and bastardized almost without exception. It's like if I told you it would be a great idea to get together on Wednesdays for Street Fighter. Sounds fun, right? But then on Wednesday, you come over with brass knuckles and start beating up my neighbors out front. That's not what I was talking about.
But it could have been.
Well, if they keep taking my parking spot, I'm seriously considering it.
Ooh, we'll just pull a Rick and Morty and get super jacked specifically so that we can beat the shit out of horrible people.
So, peace isn't the only component of Islam. The word itself means submission. The foundation of Islam is that God, or Allah, created humans for one purpose. To submit to him and worship him as the one true God. He did us all a favor by making us the pinnacle of creation above all of the animals with one thing they'll never have. That one thing is choice.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Nintendo's.
That too. We can choose to submit ourselves to Allah, or we can choose to rebel. Animals can't do this because they're stupid, especially dogs. The difference is that the cuteness of a dog actually increases with its level of stupidity, but that is not true for humans.
Ouch. Harsh.
But factual.
Hurtful, but truthful.
The problem I have with this concept is that choice isn't really a gift in this context. A dog doesn't know what Allah is and therefore can't be punished for denying him. But we can.
There will be blood. Probably from some sort of animal sacrifices. There's always animal sacrifices.
Every single time. This is the same as Christianity, in that we all assume our dogs go to heaven for not doing anything at all. But if you can't manage to believe stories about invisible people and genuine magic tricks, that's just unforgivable. Shame on you. Go to hell. Do not pass go. Give me all your dollars.
This sounds like a pretty unplayable Monopoly spinoff.
Monopoly is unplayable.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Jews don't actually have a hell, so if you're looking to convert and still not believe, you could be better off there. I don't know if that's actually valid, but we're also talking about God, so yeah.
This is how you end up with one of those clickbait advertisements. Churches hate him. Click here to find out the secret Jewish loophole.
Find out how he turned apathetic Judaism into a multi-Jew business.
Seems legit.
Not to make fun of someone's written language, but the Arabic word for Allah on Wikipedia looks like two gigantic breasts. That has nothing to do with anything, but boobs.
All right, so I guess we can check the dirty joke checkbox for this episode now. What a waste.
I'm ashamed of myself and my family.
You should be. Go commit seppuku somewhere.
Moving on. A person who practices Islam is a Muslim. The word Muslim means submitter, so again, no real creativity on the part of the religion. A Muslim's goal is to submit fully to the will of Allah and his rules for living a happy, fulfilling life. That sounds really nice, to be honest.
Except for the no more bacon rule, you wouldn't last a week.
Holy shit, you're right. Hashtag never Muslim.
Wow.
I'd love to have someone draw a detailed map of my life where every stop along the way is complete happiness, and then I wouldn't have to guess at how all this adulting shit works. But for me, the map would have to include real locations, people I can see and talk to, and things that I can actually do in real life instead of imagining I'm doing them on some ethereal plane. Seriously, adulting is hard.
Oh, for sure. What's worse, though, is adulting at an age where most people don't even consider you to be an adult. It's like I transformed into my old car and I became the No Respect Mobile all over again.
The fond memories of a shitty Taurus. Such sad. Wow.
I miss that car.
Islam, being an Abrahamic religion, is similar to Judaism and Christianity in that it prescribes rules, rituals, and behaviors that God does and doesn't like. All of these things are written down in their holy book, the Quran. The thing about the Quran, though, is that it's less like the Bible and more like the Book of Mormon.
So it's a satirical play written by the creators of South Park.
Not yet. Stay tuned. First, they have to work out the kinks on the not getting beheaded part.
Ah, yes. That is a good kink to work out.
But this isn't because it's batshit crazy and makes no sense, necessarily, but because the Quran quotes the Bible in various places, expands on biblical narratives, and assumes the reader has familiarity with biblical characters, events, and prophecies.
Ooh, the long-lost continuation.
Yeah, the Quran does not replace the Bible for Muslims. It's just a hearty sequel that was cool before sequels went mainstream. Looking at you, Disney. There are only 3 Star Wars movies. Let it fucking go.
No. Let It Go was Frozen. It is Disney, though, so you get partial credit.
I'll take it. Anyway, Muslims have a sort of reverence for the Torah, the Psalms, and the New Testament Gospels. Some passages in the Quran reference community of faith and specifically call Jews and Christians people of the book. The jury's still out on Hindus, though. No one's really sure where they fit in.
Well, if the Kama Sutra has anything to say about it, apparently they can fit however they damn well please.
Dirty joke number 2.
Cha-ching. Much better than the first.
Much. So, you might be asking yourself, where did the Quran come from?
Nope.
This is where we talk about Islam's most important prophet, Muhammad. Just in case you were wondering, the other prophets would be Adam, Seth, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, yes, that Jesus, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is the only woman named in the Quran.
All of the other women are just credited as extras on IMDb.
With memorable roles such as woman in bag or submissive wife number 3.
Ah, yes, submissive wife number 3. Excellent performance.
It was a good role. Oscar worthy. Much like Jews, Muslims do not view Jesus as divine, and especially not as the Son of God or God incarnate. Muslims believe that Jesus was a prophet of Allah who imparted good news and moral teachings. Just like Muhammad, except Muhammad was way more awesome because God dictated a book to him directly. Fucking show off.
He was the original Chris Angel. Mind freak.
He was born in Mecca in 570 CE and had a shitty and unfortunate childhood. His father was a merchant and died while out on a spice trading run to Kessel before Muhammad was born.
Was it less than 12 parsecs before he was born?
No, you nerf herder. Parsecs are distance.
Oh, sorry.
When he was 6, he was on a trip with his mother between Medina and Mecca, and halfway back she got tired of him asking, "Are we there yet?" and just gave up and died. So he stayed with his grandpa until he was 8, and then his grandpa bit it. After that, he stayed with his uncle and didn't kill any more grown-ups.
Until his uncle was shot in the street by a mugger and a radioactive spider bit him on the hand.
If only Muhammad weren't trying to impress the girl next door with a used British car, he could have saved Uncle Ben.
Uncle Ben Abu Talib, more like up top.
Ayo! His orphan origin story is special to Islam because it's viewed as God's way of strengthening him to be a prophet. Kind of like the story of Job, where God doesn't give a shit about the pain he endures just as long as he gets what he wants in the end. What doesn't kill you only gives you atomic space herpes, right?
Don't remind me.
You know God has a cure for that, right?
Yeah, but I'm sure he'd take a page out of the Martin Shkreli handbook and make you pay out the ass for it in goat sacrifices or some shit.
So he spent the next couple of decades traveling, learning languages and customs of surrounding tribes, and getting on-the-job experience as a merchant. You know, they always say you eventually become your father. It's just unavoidable.
Unless you discover the secret of time travel, warp back in time to warn your past self how not to become your father, and then heed your future self's advice.
But the advice would have come from your future self where you'd already become your father. It's a paradox.
Oh no!
Anyway, his merchant travels overseas put him in contact with Jews and Christians and gave him a basis for the different faiths he'd eventually wrap Islam around. There was a period of unrest in the area regarding the Kaaba, which is a little boxy building in the center of Mecca. It's like the first house you build in Minecraft when the sun goes down because there are skeletons everywhere and the game spawned you in the middle of a fucking desert island surrounded by ocean. Is it too much to ask for a goddamn tree?
Nah, man, it's all about a little 4x4 underground bunker. That's how you crank out the first few days before you gather enough materials. Then, if you're feeling particularly sentimental, you just carve yourself out a nice open floor plan.
Ooh, with some smooth granite and redstone light fixtures.
Ew, no, redstone is so dim. My terrible eyes can't handle that.
Anyway, the Kaaba has a magical smooth black stone in the eastern corner that was removed while the Kaaba was being renovated. Everyone started to argue about which tribe should have the honor of replacing the stone, and instead of beating each other's heads in over a stupid rock, they decided that the next man who walked through the gates would decide who got to replace the stone.
Foreshadowing much?
Cue 35-year-old Muhammad, who strolls in and gets swarmed by rock fanatics and has to make a decision.
Rock and roll!
This is the first time Muhammad's wisdom is illustrated. He asks everyone to put the stone on a blanket and each tribe to grab a corner to lift it up. With everyone participating in this silly ritual, he puts the stone back and all the little rock fanatics feel like they helped. Yay, Muhammad!
He was a pacifist before Gandhi made it cool.
Since nobody punched anyone over the incident, Muhammad is credited with avoiding a bloody tribal war over a fucking rock. After this, Muhammad became introspective. He was a loner, Dottie, a rebel.
Okay, Pee-wee.
He started wandering off into the mountains and would spend time in a cave just thinking. And maybe pooping. You don't spend that much time in a cave and not have to poop.
Maybe, but I imagine they probably didn't have the healthiest diets back then, though. Perhaps everyone was just perpetually constipated.
Nah, dates are like the prunes of the Middle East. I'm sure they were all very regular.
Oh, fair.
In 610 CE, while he was off alone, the Archangel Gabriel visited him, just like he did for Mary.
Bum, bum, bum!
Except Gabriel didn't tell Muhammad that he was going to give birth to God.
Wah, wah, wah.
Gabriel told him to recite verses, which would become the first revelation in the Quran. It goes like this.
It goes a little something like this.
Hit it! Proclaim, in the name of thy Lord and Cherisher, who created man out of a mere clot of congealed blood. Proclaim, and thy Lord is most bountiful. He who taught the use of the pen taught man that which he knew not. Trust me, you haven't really heard that verse until you've heard it in the original Klingon.
Something tells me you made that up.
No, fake news.
Okay.
Now, aside from the ridiculous claim that humans were, or are, made out of a clot of blood, as well as the unverifiable claim that God taught people how to write, there's nothing spectacular about this revelation.
It would only be spectacular if God taught people how to write in cursive. And even then, it would only be spectacular because cursive is dead as fuck.
They don't even teach cursive anymore.
Yeah, and there are still some people who are like, yes, I write in cursive. And I'm like, but everybody hates you for it, so why?
Yeah, it takes me 10 minutes just to write one word in cursive.
I'm not saying I can't appreciate art, but get over yourself, you pretentious fuck.
I don't know art, but I know what I like.
I don't get this, and I don't get magnets.
It doesn't even reveal anything. It just asserts strange factoids in the same way all religions do. So, I don't really know why anyone got all steamy about his poetry. I've heard better lyrics from a Puddle of Mud song.
She fucking hates me. I tried too hard, and she tore my feelings like I had none, and ripped them away.
Bravo. These visits and the writing of the Quran continued over the next 23 years until Muhammad died. His authoring the Quran and the occupation of Mecca are considered by Muslims to be true indicators of his status as the greatest of all prophets. By the time he died, practically everyone on the Arabian Peninsula had converted to Islam. And I don't care who you are, that's impressive as fuck.
I can't even get an entire room of people to agree on the same thing, much less indoctrinate them into the same religion.
I can't even figure out what I want for dinner.
Well, that just makes you a piece of shit.
Oh, You're not wrong.
True.
So you might be asking yourself, why am I still talking about Muhammad instead of playing Street Fighter? I'm wondering the same thing myself. It's mostly because a couple of people have told me they like this podcast for some reason, and now I can't stop blabbing into a microphone. They like us. They really like us.
Or at least they do now that we're becoming podcast famous. They want to ride the coattails of our success and piggyback off of our piggy banks. I see all y'all haters jocking us, trying to play like you know us, but we know y'all just a bunch of fakers. Our label didn't make us. We did this on our own. Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Yeah. That was inspired.
Thought I told you.
That aside, it's important to mention a couple of unbelievable miracles attributed to Muhammad. If you thought wooden submarines and galactic overlord alien accountants were funny, you'll love this.
I did indeed love the wooden submarine.
The most formative miracle of Muhammad was said to have occurred one night around the year 621 while he was chilling in his man cave. He was visited by a flying horse with a human face named Barak.
Is this why everybody wanted to see Obama's birth certificate?
That would be funny if our president were a horse with a human face.
He did a pretty good job of hiding it, let's be honest.
It was the suits.
Right.
The tan suits.
Yes.
So the horsey flew him to Jerusalem so he could pray with other prophets, and then took him to heaven so he could meet Abraham, Moses, John the Baptist, and Jesus. I don't know if this was your standard meet and greet where they just exchanged some pleasantries and then Jesus was like, ooh, look at the time. I've got a thing in the morning. I'd better hit the sack. And then the others were like, oh, yeah, I have a thing, too. Well, it was nice to meet you, Mo. Bye.
Are you saying that even omnipotent deities still have to make things up to get out of socializing?
Yeah.
Oh, seems legit.
It's just social convention.
Fair enough.
It doesn't go away after you become omnipotent.
Well, at least deities are respectful.
Yeah. So before Barak dropped Muhammad off at his cave, God told him that it would be frickin' sweet if he prayed 5 times a day. This miracle, called the night flight, is marked on the Islamic calendar, so it's a thing that people believe happened.
The night flight sounds like a vigilante superhero group. Night flight also kind of sounds like a rock song.
Oh, yeah. Like a Journey song.
Journey down the night flight!
It's a night flight! Another big miracle that I totally believe, because there's no way it didn't happen, is that Muhammad split the moon in half. It was kind of like a Moses in Egypt situation where unbelievers were asking him for a sign that he wasn't just a crazy person. So Muhammad prayed and the moon split in half and set into the horizon on two sides of a mountain.
I'll reiterate my previous claim that Muhammad was the original Chris Angel, because that's some straight smoke and mirrors shit right there.
That's a lot like a David Copperfield thing. Like, he made the space shuttle disappear, right?
Oh, fuck it. No way.
He actually did it.
I believe that. That's crazy shit, bro. Holy crap.
It totally happened, bro. You know how people who weren't there for it were convinced it really happened? Some other people said they saw it. Well, not them, but like their brother's best friend's uncle, who doesn't ever lie about anything, for serious.
Is that the same person you were asking about deleting internet porn history for? You need some new friends, Robert.
Yeah, Robert.
Robert.
Yeah. There's another one about him breaking a boulder with an axe, but it's stupid, so who cares? You can't throw something like that in after you just split the fucking moon. Jeez.
Yeah, everybody knows that there's a precedence to awesomeness. Splitting the moon? Gold tier. Splitting a boulder? Trash tier. Get good, son.
Speaking of splitting the moon, Islam is also split. The two main sects of Islam are Sunni and Shia. Sunni are the majority of Muslims, like maybe upward of 90% of Muslims.
What the fuck kind of segue was that? I'm supremely disappointed in you.
This is my show. Sit back.
This is my show!
There are 5 pillars for Sunni Muslims. The first is faith, much like any other religion. The statement of faith in Islam is, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. You can't be a Muslim if you don't say these words. It's like a magic incantation that works like a polyjuice potion, where it allows you to become a Muslim, but the effects will wear off after a while, so you have to say it again periodically.
That was the dankest simile I've heard all week. Kudos.
Yes, winning.
No, no more.
Damn.
Outdated memes make you lose points.
Oh, okay. The second pillar is prayer. As I mentioned before, there are 5 named prayer times. Dawn, noon, afternoon, evening, and night. Those aren't very specific, to be honest. I don't know where the hard line between afternoon and evening is. Maybe it's like snack time and dinner time. You don't want to snack too close to dinner or you'll ruin your appetite. So I wonder if praying too close to evening spoils your prayers. It's a mystery to last the ages.
Let's break out the scientific method and test this shit out.
All right, I'll pray now. You pray in 1 hour.
All right, sounds good. We need a control.
Well, I mean, like all of the other Muslims who are actually good Muslims are probably praying on time, right?
Fair enough.
Okay. So the third pillar is charity, which is awesome. I'm cool with helping the less fortunate and eliminating inequality for sure. But I've mentioned before that there's a weird feeling I get when someone does the right thing for the wrong reasons, and this is kind of one of those.
Like rescuing a baby from a burning building so that they can feast on its well-cooked flesh later on?
Well, yeah, because raw babies are disgusting.
For sure.
The reason charity exists in the pillars is because of the fundamental view that everything belongs to God, and the reason for giving your wealth away is to reap a reward in the afterlife. There are even rules for giving what is essentially a tithe called the zakat.
Of course there are rules for being philanthropic. Why wouldn't there be?
Right. They go like this. 1, you have to announce to God that your intention is to be charitable. That's weird. 2, there's a due date on your zakat. 3, you can't brag about what you gave. The first rule of zakat club is you can't talk about zakat club.
I hope that one is verbatim.
I think it might be. 4, what you give has to be proportional to what you own. I don't know how they verify this, just like with Christian tithes. I would hope someone isn't all up in your business like, did you forget that you also have that really nice jacket? That counts too.
They actually make you hand in all your W-2s and show them an up-to-date copy of your credit report?
Yeah. And your mother's maiden name and your birthday.
Social security card.
Yeah, exactly.
All that jazz.
So, 5 is what you give stays in the community where you gave it. So, it's not like Christian missionary offerings that get sent to Haiti or anything. So, the 4th pillar is fasting. I'm so not on board with this one, although my waistline would thank me. I just really love food.
Though you really might notice some improvements if you went from eating an entire pizza in one sitting to only eating half an entire pizza in one sitting.
Well, yeah, but then what do I do with the other half? Just throw it away? There are starving children in Africa.
You bag it up and you put it in the fridge for meal part 2 later on.
Yeah. Unpopular opinion, cold pizza fucking sucks.
That's why I've actually found the secret. You just got to sprinkle a little bit of water on the pizza and then sprinkle a little bit of water on a paper towel that you put over the pizza and boom, it's like brand new.
Okay, so I've got an idea. Why don't you just eat the whole thing?
Fuck you.
Anyway, you've probably heard of Ramadan. It's an entire month of people being super grumpy because they can't eat anything from dawn to dusk, but they still have to go about their normal lives.
Wait, does that mean they can have midnight snacks?
Ah, good question.
Fucking loophole.
It's supposed to remove distractions so Muslims can be closer to God. But if you've ever heard my girlfriend's stomach when she hasn't eaten anything for about an hour, you'd know what distraction truly is. It sounds like a grizzly bear trying to get to Leo DiCaprio's soft, chewy center.
Is Leonardo DiCaprio a Tootsie Roll Pop? Where's Mr. Owl when you need him?
Hey, and you're talking about my outdated memes.
Yeah, man.
Fuck you, man.
Mr. Owl, how many licks does it take to get to the Tootsie Roll Center of a Tootsie Pop? Nailed it.
The last pillar is a pilgrimage to Mecca. Every able-bodied Muslim is required to make a trip to Mecca at least once in their life. The people traveling to Mecca are known as Hajj. While they're there, they have to do a number of completely sane and normal things, like walk 7 times around the Kaaba.
Thou shalt count to 7, no more, no less. 7 shall be the number thou shalt count, and the number of the counting shall be 7. 8 shalt thou not count, neither count thou 6, excepting that thou then proceed to 7.
9 is right out! If you've ever seen a video of this, it's nuts. There's an endless ocean of people just filing through gates in a circle around the Minecraft house like a serpentine belt on an old tractor. After they do their 7th lap, they have to touch the magical black stone, go from one mountain to another 7 times, and then symbolically stone the devil.
First go like this, spin around, stop, double take 3 times, 1, 2, 3, then pelvic thrust, woo! Woo! Stop on your right foot, don't forget it! Now it's time to bring it around town. Bring it around town.
So, you really happy with your SpongeBob reference there?
Yeah, I've stooped pretty low now, haven't I?
No, SpongeBob references are awesome.
I'm Dirty Dan.
No, I'm Dirty Dan.
No, I'm Dirty Dan.
Any of your bubble-blowing babies?
You can be Dirty Dan, SpongeBob. I just want to be Patrick.
So, Shia Muslims don't have these same pillars, and in fact reject the Sunni pillars because, much like Catholics and Protestants, they're right and the other one is wrong. Shia seems to be more socially structured, with a strong foundation on a caliphate where a successor to Muhammad is seen as the rightful leader appointed by God.
But was he anointed by God?
I think it's implied.
It's implied that he gets rubbed with oil by God?
Yeah, rubbed down.
Seems legit. Sign me up.
Shia Islam has something in their foundation Sunni Islam doesn't, the call to jihad. The word is associated with holy war, but what it really means is struggle. This can be a struggle against a believer's human nature to sin, or it can be a struggle against non-believers trying to un-Muslimify you. The second meaning leads to forced conversion, which is prohibited in the Quran, but, you know, who reads the Quran anyway?
It could also be a struggle to cope with the death of your uncle and your subsequent call to arms against evildoers in your city. Yeah, that's right. I backed all the way up to the start of the show to make a callback, because that is commitment.
I'm actually surprised you even remember the beginning of this episode.
Fuck you. And everything you stand for.
So, warring between Islamic factions and the mistreatment and murder of Christians in the Middle East have been attributed to jihad, as well as terrorist attacks throughout the world. So this is what happens when you take shit too far, man. You get the Crusades and 9/11. Stop it. Get some help.
I think you're the one who needs some help. Don't you know that those are both conspiracies? Quit buying into the government's bullshit, man. Hashtag jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
You know what does melt steel beams?
Memes.
Dank memes. So, Shia Islam also wars against Sunni Islam and non-believers because of fatwa, or permission to do something that would ordinarily go against Islamic law, like, you know, killing people.
Or eating bacon.
I actually don't think they back down on that one.
Hmm.
That's really odd. Like, yeah, you can go kill people, but don't eat bacon. That's fucked
that
up.
That should be like one of those things, and because I know that there's a bunch of stuff in like Christianity and Catholicism where they're like, some people are like, oh yeah, you totally can't do this, and other people are like, what? No, you can, you're fine. Just pray about it later.
Well, actually, it's funny that you say that, because there's a concept called fatwa shopping, where Muslims will ask different sheikhs the same question until they get the answer they want. It's like when you want to go to a party and you ask your dad, but he says no. So then you go to your mom and say, dad said it was okay with him if it was okay with you. And she says yes. And then they get in a fight and divorce and neither one of them wants you because they blame you for destroying their lives. And you have to join the circus and clean the elephant stalls. It's just like that.
Dude, this is exactly what happened to me. My parents fucking sucked. And that's why I hate elephants now.
Well, elephants hate you too.
You're not wrong.
But fatwa isn't a core Islamic concept, and it's problematic because it can lead to things like the Charlie Hebdo attack over cartoons of Muhammad. And even though there's a prohibition against making images and idols, just like in the Bible, there's no Islamic law calling for the death of people who draw a prophet. I want everyone to remember this when they see the episode artwork this week. There's no death sentence for drawing Muhammad.
Oh my god, you're gonna get us killed. If not by Trump, then by religious nutjobs.
Eh, we all die someday.
Wow.
Because of all of this, moderate Muslims in Western societies have a tough job of convincing people that terrorists aren't real Muslims. It's a very bold example of the no true Scotsman fallacy, where a person does something really bad in the name of your in-group or your god, and even though they've made their motives clear as being linked to your in-group or your god, you shrug it off and say, meh, they're not a real Muslim. That's just bullshit apologetics and self-preservation. You know what would be better than disowning the terrorists? Disowning your religion, especially when it can be warped and twisted to fit a psychopathic view of aggression. That goes for all religions, but especially for a gigantic religion that so easily produces fanatics. I've been really excited for this week's guest. She's got a wealth of knowledge and experience and is a much better conversationalist than me. She's the author of the Nice Mangoes blog, host of the Polite Conversations podcast, and Canadian ex-Muslim, Ina. I'm so glad you could join me today.
I'm glad I'm here. Thanks for having me on and for that lovely intro.
I do what I can. So I have a lot of questions that I want to ask you, but I want to start with you specifically. What got you interested in podcasting?
Well, I was blogging already, and then it seemed like the next natural step. Like, I wanted to say a lot of things, and I think that podcasting was just a better medium for some conversations as opposed to blogging. Like, I mean, there are some things that I will want to blog about even now that I podcast. Like, some things are better written down so you can refer back to them and have everything in front of you. But some things are better in conversation, I think.
Right. Well, and it's really difficult to have any kind of meaningful conversation through blog comment sections or, you know, back and forth articles, you know, dueling articles. So
Right, yeah, exactly.
And I do think that, you know, podcasting, as far as your Polite Conversations podcast, is certainly a better platform than blogging, because it does give you the opportunity to just kind of engage with someone and really just talk through points and have a polite conversation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for conversations with other people, podcasting is great. For making note of things and having a record of them. I mean, podcasting works in ways too, but blogging works in some cases better for that.
Right.
Like, if I'm writing an article about Peterson and I want to document all the crazy stuff he said, then I might prefer to blog about it.
Right. And in a case like that, where someone might potentially be litigious, then it's nice to have kind of a paper trail as well. So every episode of your podcast begins with this delightful clip of your dad telling you not to be controversial. So have you disappointed him?
In terms of being controversial, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I've lived up to his expectations, I think.
Okay.
In that he knows that I'm going to be controversial. And, you know, you can almost like hear him rolling his eyes in that, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah, my dad knows me.
Well, that's good. I always love that intro, because every time it comes on, it always makes me smile.
Thanks. I'm glad to hear that. I'll pass that along. He likes to hear about responses to the intro, too.
Oh, okay. So you blog about sexuality in Pakistan and the surrounding area. So what are some of your main focuses, and what are the problems that you see on that topic?
So I used to blog about sexuality in Pakistan and, you know, within Muslim communities a lot more a couple of years ago. Nowadays, I've sort of been focusing on politics, religion, and just like the politics within the atheist scene. So back then, I did find, obviously, a lot of issues, you know, in terms of women not being able to speak out openly, the double standards, the traditional gender roles. And so I wrote a lot about that. And coming into the atheist scene, it was comforting to know that maybe I had left those things behind. I was going to have an audience that wouldn't cling to those things. It was a different experience at first, but now very much we're getting back into the, you know, with people like Jordan Peterson being admired, the traditional gender roles and can men and women really work together? We don't know. Women wear lipstick and high heels to work. I mean, they're hypocrites if they expect not to be sexually harassed. So I'm finding a lot of similar themes.
And, you know, it's kind of like you said, that there are some politics now and there's some factioning in the atheist community. And there's kind of a lot to deal with, and I guess a lot to blog about now. For sure. But along those lines, you know, the atheist community is definitely not immune to these problems. And one of the problems that's been at the forefront recently is the issue of feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And
struggle I had with Pakistani and Muslim conservatives as well.
Right. Which is, and that's so odd that you would, you know, when you leave religion, you're like, okay, now I'm done with that. And now you're not.
Yep.
it's really sad.
It's depressing. Yeah, it is.
As far as feminist goals in Western culture, how do those goals differ in Middle Eastern and Asian culture? Like some people that I've talked to, they've said that, you know, women in Arab countries or in predominantly Muslim countries have it so much worse, and Western women should just stop bitching and we should help out the people that have it so much worse. And I'm like, well, I mean, you can multitask, right?
Right, absolutely. And I mean, I used to hear that argument from Pakistani conservatives all the time. Well, at least this isn't Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, if you can find one place worse than you, then you can deflect the conversation from yourself and refuse to take responsibility or refuse to address issues within your own communities. So I don't think that's a helpful tactic at all. I mean, imagine if in free speech conversations that was used, like, oh, look at these Western free speechers whining about not being allowed to invite Nazis to school. At least they don't have like the real free speech problems like blasphemy laws or being stoned to death. And, you know, you can just deflect conversations that way forever.
Right. And I think it's like there are some times where you look at, you know, problems that you're having and you want to have a little bit of perspective about them and be like, okay,
yeah, of course.
To me, this is bad. But then I realize that there are people who are just like, they don't know where their next meal is coming from and that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And so mm-hmm. putting that in perspective, like, it can definitely, you know, help you to deal with your problems a little bit better. But when we're talking about societal problems, a problem is a problem, right? I mean, do we put degrees on it and then like make sure that 100% of our focus is on the worst thing?
Well, no, we wouldn't get anywhere like that, right? As soon as something improved from being the worst thing, then you could no longer ask for betterment.
Right.
So that doesn't work. However, that's not to say that, you know, feminism is flawless and perfect in the West and that it never does something that I disagree with. I mean, I've criticized feminists and feminism plenty before. It's just that now I think that the anti-SJW side has gotten out of hand a little bit and embodies some of the things that they complain about the SJWs being, you know, the constant victimhood. And when you go so overboard, it's very hard to have a sensible conversation. Similarly, with the conversation of Islam, like, I'm not at all a fan at all. Obviously, I left it. I'm a woman who grew up in Saudi Arabia. But the conversation that I often hear in the atheist scene now has gone overboard to the point where it's hard to have a sensible adult critical conversation about Islam when people are screeching about, you know, eradicating it or, you know, saying that it cannot be reformed or saying that there's a tidal wave of Muslims coming to replace Westerners and just absurd and sometimes dangerous stuff.
And certainly the xenophobia and,
yeah, exactly.
And just, I mean, the word Islamophobia has sort of become meaningless to me because people have thrown it around so much and so loosely. Like, mm-hmm. For instance, like, let's take Ben Affleck. When Sam Harris was criticizing Islam, Ben Affleck called him a racist.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And I can't really square that. To me, that doesn't seem mm-hmm. like an accurate statement. Is it racist to criticize Islam or?
Absolutely not. No way. Okay. It's just important to criticize all religion and not to protect certain ideas. But when you're surrounded by xenophobes jumping on those points, then you have to be careful in who you ally with, what platforms you choose, who you choose to elevate. You can't go on Breitbart. You can't be supporting people like Dave Rubin, who, you know, promotes all sorts of xenophobes and, you know, people who use terms like rape fugees and things like that.
Oh my God.
That's where the racism and bigotry come in.
Absolutely. So, and the way that I view it is Islam is a religion, just like Christianity. Mm-hmm. And we here in the West can, you know, poke fun at Christianity and Mormonism and Scientology and like just whatever. But the moment that you start criticizing Islam, somebody is going to call you a racist or as an Islamophobe. And you're not even like, I feel like there's a big difference between addressing people and addressing their beliefs.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of the whole thing with, you know, this podcast is, like, we're talking about the beliefs, we're talking about the doctrine, we're talking about the rituals and just how weird they are. Mm-hmm. And Islam is no different.
Absolutely not. But you see, to create an environment where people trust people who criticize Islam, to create an environment where it's comfortable to talk about it like we would with any other religion over here, we have to sort of distance ourselves from anti-Muslim bigotry or make it apparent that we don't stand for that. And I don't think that a lot of the anti-Islam big name atheists have made that convincingly clear enough. So while it is absolutely not bigoted to criticize the idea Islam or the doctrines, which are regressive and misogynistic and homophobic, it is bigoted to like associate with or, you know, to praise anti-immigrants and bring up these race IQ conversations in an irresponsible manner without presenting proper valid critiques of those or ways in which those were the research about those were compromised, if you understand what I'm saying.
Right.
Like, there's a lot surrounding the people that like to talk about Islam a lot. And it's not as simple as just discussing ideas versus people. It goes into people. When you associate with anti-immigrants who say things like, you know, we should make conditions harder for Muslims across the board in Europe. Or when you, you know, are praising people who are going on the news and saying, you know, even if they are the nicest Muslims, what about their future children? They could turn out to be terrorists. That's when it gets into bigotry.
Yeah, and I think that that's essentially what you're saying is that the people who are anti-immigrant and xenophobic about Muslims, they are essentially just projecting. Doesn't it seem like they have these fears and these internal biases that they're just kind of pawning off on people who are different?
Yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense. That's a given with xenophobes, right?
Right.
They fear people who are different.
So if the people who are anti-immigrant and the people who are anti-Muslim are talking about Muslim bans and stuff like that, like when they do that, are we building up more resentment and just kind of stoking fires or just generally making people's lives more difficult in other areas of the world?
Both.
Right.
Yeah. So in a climate where Muslim bans are being talked about by people in power, we have to obviously be careful of how we phrase our criticisms of Islam, right? So if we're going on Breitbart and saying that Islam is a religion that cannot be reformed and it should be eradicated or it does not belong on this planet, or if we, you know, one problem I'm having a lot is with ex-Muslims who are going around saying things like Islam is worse than Nazism. In a time where actually neo-Nazis are on the rise,
right.
I find statements like that to be incredibly harmful to the conversation around Islam and even counterproductive. If you want criticism of Islam to resonate with a wider audience, to make reactionary statements like Islam is worse than Nazism, you're just going nowhere. You're just going to restrict yourself to a right-wing, Breitbart-type, Fox News-type crowd.
Okay, so I think that kind of ties into a question that I have about Islam. And it seems like when we look at examples of predominantly Muslim cultures, is that maybe perhaps we're only seeing like the worst examples over here in the West. And so we're getting kind of a skewed view of what a predominantly Muslim culture even looks like. Is that true?
To an extent, yeah. Of course, you're only going to hear about the worst things in the news, and you're not going to hear about the minority of liberal, progressive people that are trying to fight that bullshit just as much as you or I would be. So it's a disservice to act like they don't exist, you know what I mean?
Right. It's kind of like how the news doesn't report every plane that lands safely.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my question would be, knowing that the doctrine of Islam is very misogynistic and very authoritarian, is it right to view these cultures as like not congruent with human rights? Like that we do need to change these cultures? Like, it's not like we can do it from over here and just be like, hey, Saudi Arabia, stop that, and and it changes overnight. We can't do that. But like, are we right in thinking that these cultures need to change?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, any ideology that's like over 1,000 years old, right, it's not gonna work today.
Right. Well, especially if it refuses to modernize.
Right. So I think that's just a basic truth. But that doesn't mean that every Muslim is a robot that follows scripture to the T. You know what I mean? Like, Muslims are diverse in how they practice, how they interpret. They're like flawed human beings like any other set of theists. So if you see like these people practicing watered down Christianity where they cherry pick and practice it, the Muslims are just the same.
Yeah. And I think that that gets back to the difference between, you know, viewing Muslims as people versus viewing them as this tribe, or I don't know if that's the right word, but just like kind of lumping them all in together and saying, well, this is what Islam says, so all of these people think that, and they're all bad.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I mean, there are large percentages of people who believe in some pretty awful things because of religion. There's no denying that. But at the same time, you have to recognize that, you know, Muslims are not a monolith. Islam is not a monolith. Even the ways in which it has been practiced in varying times throughout history shows that, you know, it has the capability of being less jihadi than it is today.
Okay, well, and not only that, but just like Christianity and other religions, you have sects and splinters within the religion that practice entirely different versions of Islam.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not at all attached to Islam in any way. I don't really care for it. But I think that the way to effectively have it harm less people, like any other religion, is to let it naturally sort of get declawed, watered down, rather than these angry, raging calls for eradicating it.
So you are clearly then in the reformer camp. And I've seen other ex-Muslims who are like, no, it can't be reformed. It's beyond redemption. It just needs to be destroyed, just like you're saying.
Yes, I think that's very unhelpful, short-sighted, and silly, frankly.
Right. And I think that, you know, our view as atheists on Christianity specifically, we say, you know, it's kind of dumb to believe that. I think that, you know, they're doing some harm to society with trying to implement their religious views in the government. But ultimately, if they can just, you know, practice their religion in their churches and just keep it to themselves, then we really don't have a problem with it. But we're not that way with Muslims. And I think that it's just because, like I said earlier, like what we're seeing of Islam is like all of the planes that crash instead of the ones that land, right?
Well, also, you know, it is a more orthodox religion than Christianity right now.
Right. Okay.
It does command stricter level of adherence over the people that follow it, you know? So that is a real issue. It hasn't been watered down or declawed in the way that Christianity has. But all these calls for eradicating it are only going to push people to like dig their heels in.
Yeah, those are kind of your choices, right? Are to integrate into society, to kind of modernize your religion, or have people come at you, right?
Well, and people are coming at them all the time, right. You know, which is so horrible because, I mean, it's just because it's so inhumane, but it's horrible because for people who actually want to have a grown-up critical conversation about Islam or things like the hijab or the niqab, how do you do that in a climate where women are getting attacked for their hijabs and niqabs while they're walking around not hurting anyone?
Right.
You know, it seems like you're piling on then, and it's very hard to do. So it's like power balances are important, right? So I dislike Christianity very much as well.
Yes.
And I'm not going to change my views on that even when I'm in Pakistan. Even though, you know, Christians aren't treated very well and they're a very vulnerable minority. However, I'm not going to go on right-wing Islamist channels and join hands with them and share my criticisms of Christianity with them, because that is dangerous in that climate.
Right. And just feeds into the never-ending us versus them mentality.
Yes. And so, just the hate.
Yeah. If what you think needs to happen is reform, that's not something that comes from atheists on the outside. That I think
atheists could certainly be helpful towards making that happen, but I don't think that in the current state the movement is, that it is very helpful at all.
Because we're too hostile and we're not having rational conversations with people
and also
who could
because
be reformers, right?
The bigger names are sort of allying with right-wing voices and also picking reformers to elevate that are pretty right-wing, either open Trump supporters, people who defended the Muslim ban. These are not people whose voices are going to be taken seriously in the community, in the Muslim community.
So if we have any role in this reform, it would be in trying to identify moderate Muslims.
I would say, like, find progressive voices from Muslim communities that are fighting for, like, LGBT rights and feminist rights and, you know, elevate those voices. Find voices specifically that do not head in that right-wing direction. I mean, I don't know if have you heard of Raif Badawi and that whole case about the Saudi blogger that got imprisoned for criticizing Islam in Saudi Arabia in a blog post?
I do remember hearing
like
that, yes.
Lashes and it's very, very sad what happened to him. And, you know, it's not at all okay. I hope that he gets out someday and that the international community can put enough pressure on the Saudi government to shame them into releasing him. However, at the same time, his wife, who campaigns on his behalf over here, she's in Canada, has completely sort of lost the plot. She is like championing alt-right figures who said they wouldn't get into a cab with a Muslim-looking driver. She's calling them like conservative heroes, retweeting InfoWars, hating on the left, you know, mocking feminism, making bigoted jokes with Ann Coulter on her Twitter. It's like, that's not helping anyone.
No, I guess I'm just, I just don't know where Islam is going. Like, is it fighting? Is it kicking and screaming in the modern world and just refusing to grow up?
I think that to an extent it can't refuse. And that's what all this violent lashing out is. Like, it's at war with modernity, with the world around it. And I don't think it's going to win. It just can't. Like, there are too many views accessible now to everyone.
Right. So
things are changing slowly. There are some LGBT-friendly mosques, not many, just a handful, and they get a lot of hate.
Okay. But
they do exist. There are some women leading prayer. You know, I mean, if you ask me my personal views on it, I think, you know, how the hell can you be a religious feminist? Because I think the religion is misogynistic in itself. But power to you. If that is the path you want to take, I will support you. I will just not try to probably not bring up how misogynistic religion is around you, because then we're going to argue probably. But if you want to go ahead and, you know, fight for women's rights to lead prayer, then go for it. Because I think that different paths need to be open, right? There are some people who prefer to take baby steps. They cannot just abandon everything, the whole framework of everything they've ever known all of a sudden.
Right.
And it's easier to sort of let go in small steps. If you want to be a gay religious person, again, I don't personally understand that at all, when I believe right. It's a religion that does not make space for you, that rejects you outright. But, you know, I've had a Muslim drag queen on my show, and that was a very interesting conversation.
Oh, I missed that episode. I'm going to have to go back and listen to it.
Yeah, you should.
I will. So then, you know, it's nice that there are examples of more progressive Muslims, but I mean, just in general, do the different sects of Islam vary that widely, where like maybe you can identify a certain branch of Islam that's just naturally a little more progressive? Or
yeah, Ahmadis are known to be more, you know, softer and more progressive. Sufis. But again, it also varies from family to family, right? Like, there are people from all sects with families that are on the more hardcore side and on the barely practicing side, unless you're counting Salafism and Wahhabism. Those are just like inherently hardcore.
Right.
But I'm sure there's some variation within them too. Like, I'm sure they have their version of more progressive. Like, okay. Maybe they allow, like, I don't know, a lighter colored burqa as opposed to a dark. I don't know.
Okay. So when we're talking about these, you know, the more hardcore sects and the more progressive sects, it seems like what we hear a lot is that there's war within Islam between these different sects. And
oh, of course, they're seen as like heretics.
And so is it Islam itself that causes them to be a little more prone to violence as compared to, like, when we're talking about Christianity, you know, the Catholics just kind of sneer at the Protestants?
Well, that's now, right?
Yeah. I mean, oh, yeah, it didn't always used to be that way.
Yeah, so Islam is just at that phase. It has not watered down. It's that orthodoxy, again, that has not, you know, gone away yet.
Okay, so is that just because it's younger than
That's part of it, I think. Part of it. But, of course, it has less excuse now in the internet era. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah, I do think that things have started to change slowly, slowly now, and also will continue to change. But it is a younger religion, and it's more hardcore still. We haven't penetrated that.
And it's going through its growing pains the way that other religions have in the past, but we just get to see that more now than we did.
Well, we weren't around then.
Right. So what I'm wondering is, with you specifically being an ex-Muslim and not being afraid to just be outspoken, do you have challenges that you face just with, you know, what you do with your blog and your podcast?
Yeah, in so many ways. I mean, there's obviously the speaking out about Islam challenge, the being an open apostate challenge, which, you know, gets me death threats and rape threats. Oof. And now in the Trumpian alt-right environment, I get threats from like people from the Western far right too. People calling me like a third world parasite, you know, Muslim scum. We should have you forcefully sterilized. We should bomb your family. So it doesn't really matter that I'm ex-Muslim. I mean, to xenophobes, right?
Right.
I'm still like the person from that background.
Wow. That That's just awful.
Yeah, it's pretty awful.
Oh, man. How long have you been ex-Muslim?
I think I stopped practicing when I was a teenager. But I didn't really have the language or the understanding or even a community, you know, to understand that I'm like ex-Muslim. I didn't know it was a thing that you could leave Islam. I just became like just non-practicing, non-religious. Okay. So, yeah, I'd say like half my life at least. But openly, I've only been speaking about it for like, I'd say like, I don't know, 6 to 8 years, 8 years maybe. I'm not entirely sure. Something like that.
Okay. So I first became aware of you through like reposts on social media.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so and that's one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on is that I've known about you for quite some time, and I've been kind of following your stuff as much as I can. But I get overwhelmed with a lot of the issues that we deal with in the atheist community and like all of the people and the personalities. And it just seems like things are going so quickly around me. I get overloaded.
Completely understandable. It's very overwhelming and frustrating.
Do you now consider yourself an atheist?
Yeah. I do. I'm a bit embarrassed by some atheists, but I still consider myself an atheist. That's probably not going to change.
Right.
Though I've seen a lot of people like remove it from their bios and their, you know, social media handles, and people don't want to be associated with the community or the word. And it's been sad to see a lot of good atheist accounts just like change their names. And I never put atheist in my Twitter bio. I never put ex-Muslim because I know that the kinds of people that are specifically attracted by people who hinge their entire identities around that. And I wasn't looking to attract that, especially the ones who are like looking for ex-Muslims specifically.
Okay.
So it's not something that I'll like put in my Twitter bio. But if, you know, if I have a chance to write something a little bit longer, like I think in my podcast description, I wrote that, you know, something from a liberal ex-Muslim perspective.
So you are in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, because I don't know much about atheist culture in Canada. We just get snippets of it. But what is the religious, what is the atheist culture like in Canada as compared to the U.S.?
Well, I think
if you could comment on that.
The U.S. is definitely more religious. I don't really hear about religion here in that way, you know, like don't really hear about people trying to teach creationism in schools and people trying to bring religion into government and things like that.
Okay.
Rarely hear about that. And, you know, most of my friends are like non-religious. They might not necessarily identify as atheists, but we all like joke about religion together.
Okay. But religion as a whole is just not as big a part of public life as here in the US.
No, I don't think that it is. I mean, Canada on the whole is a more progressive country, I think.
It certainly seems like it.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, speaking of the US, are you going to make any appearances, maybe the American Atheist Convention, or will we be able to see you anywhere?
So because of the threats that I received from the beginning when I started blogging,
okay,
I just decided that I would remain anonymous and I prefer like just to be not recognized. So I'm going to stay anonymous. And, you know, in terms of being an artist, it's kind of fun as well, like putting art out there without people knowing who I am. Sometimes my art has been picked up, like by, for example, one time it was picked up by a politician in Pakistan, and something that I made was like plastered all over a city that I used to live in, and nobody knew it was me. And that was kind of cool, kind of frustrating as well, but well, you know, like,
yeah, it's not as though you get any credit or recognition for it.
Yeah.
That would stink.
Yeah.
Well, no, I can completely understand that. I mean, I don't, like, I have no relative experience with that. And, you know, I guess part of that is just like, I'm a white dude, so I don't have those concerns. So I'm really sorry that you experienced that. And I'm really sorry that we don't get to see you in person.
Yeah, maybe someday, you know, like if, I don't know, if I had more resources to invest in my security and things like that, that would make me feel more secure.
Right.
Then maybe. But right now, I'm not really in a position to take those risks, I think.
Oh, well, that just sounds horrible.
Like, I've had to decline, like, TV appearances, you know, that would have been very good for my exposure for my work, you know?
Right.
So there was one time where Bill Maher actually asked me to come on, and that didn't quite work out because of my request for anonymity and stuff like that. So,
well, I had no idea that that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So now you're just stooping really low to obscure podcasts.
Right. They won't find me here.
No, I don't think anyone's going to find you here.
I have no problems like appearing anywhere if it's just my voice. Like, I've been on Canadian national radio and stuff. But, you know, that's a risk too, actually. My lawyer was like, are you sure you want to do that? But I got to, I mean, if I want to speak, I have to take some risks. But I'd really rather not have people, I don't know, recognize me in public and say, hurl it. Like, if real life is to be anything like how people treat me on Twitter sometimes, like, I don't want people, like, if I'm out for dinner with my family and be like, you third world parasite, bomb Muslims. Or on the other hand, some other Muslim conservative coming to me and be like, you dirty apostate. Like, I don't need to be sandwiched in real life with that hate.
Right. It is my biggest hope that real life never becomes like Twitter, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But bad. Speaking of Twitter, what can we link in the show notes where people can find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Nice Mangoes, no E in mangoes. And you can find my podcast on soundcloud.com/politeconversations.
Well, that's easy. And are you also on Facebook?
I am on Facebook. You can just like Google Ina Nice Mangoes, Ina being E-I-Y-N-A-H, and Nice Mangoes, you know how to spell. But I have been taken off of Facebook like a few times now. I don't know if it's like 3 or what. Like, people used to like report my content for criticizing Islam, and then I got reported for criticizing a terrible bigoted critic of Islam. And so, like, you know, when they organize these like false mass flagging campaigns, Facebook doesn't really have humans looking at it. So it gets taken off. And also because I did not use my real name. So Facebook had that terrible real name rule. Oh, so if someone reported you for having a pseudonym, Facebook would suspend your account.
Okay. And without any real context or research into why you would be doing that in the first place.
Yeah, there was a whole campaign about it, like people that were domestic abuse victims and like trans people who changed their name, like native activists, all sorts of people were affected by their real name rule. Right. And I don't think that it's been changed. So they gave me the option, like I managed to get in touch through someone with someone who worked at Facebook who wasn't very helpful at all, but she gave me the option of having a business Facebook account, which is not like a normal Facebook account. Like, I can't have friends, I can't like pages, and it's very annoying. But no one can report me for having a pseudonym on that because it's a business Facebook account. So
okay. Well, I mean, social media is weird. Facebook is kind of dumb.
Facebook is terrible. I hate it.
But you also have a Patreon page, right?
I do.
If you want to plug that, I will link absolutely. It as well.
It is patreon.com/nicemangoes. No E in mangoes.
No E, people.
That's right.
All right. Well, I really want to thank you for just hanging out with me. And I wish that I could have kind of verbalized my questions a little bit better sometimes, but I really enjoyed having a conversation with you.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me on.
Mario Kart 8!
What are you buying?
Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die. Come watch TV.
Teach me.
No.
And welcome back, guys and gals and people that don't associate themselves with either of the cisgenders.
Also furries.
Sure.
It's okay, furry listeners. I got you.
Well, I guess we also have to include people who are... What is that new... The new one that's like identifying as somebody who is a child on the inside and is in love with other children?
I'm glad I don't know what you're talking about.
So anyway, everyone, make sure you've got a box of tissues nearby because this week we're talking about porn.
Ooh, I'm fairly confident that I already know the answer to this question, but I have to ask anyway. So what even is porn?
Yeah, you're probably no stranger, you pervy old man.
Hey, I'm not old.
According to who?
People older than me.
Fair enough.
There are like a couple of people that are older than me.
Story of my life. So, porn or pornography is, quote, the portrayal of sexual subject matter for the exclusive purpose of sexual arousal, unquote. Any teenager who's discovered the secret to surviving puberty most likely knows what porn is. So, the thing about porn is that it's been around for literally millennia. There's an ancient Egyptian papyrus scroll painting called the Turin Erotic Papyrus, found from 1150 BC, and it contains very, very, like, hardcore drawings of dudes boning women and, like, yanking on their hair and spanking them and stuff. It's pretty hardcore.
So the Egyptians liked it rough, is what you're saying.
Apparently.
So this Turin Erotic Papyrus is definitely different from the Shroud of Turin, which does not explicitly show Jesus's penis.
Probably. Yeah, this is like specifically, it's actually referred to as the like the first porn magazine, basically, because it's just like a scroll that has nothing but just like lewd drawings all over it.
Ooh, nice. I feel like somebody's missing out on a niche market with porn papyruses.
Yeah, we need to go back to that. Get all the papyruses out here. Papyri?
Papyri.
Popery? So anyway, we're talking ancient Egypt there. And I'm sure that there was probably some stuff scattered here and there, but that's the most notable one because it's the earliest tracked drawn erotica that we can find. But the first softcore pornographic magazines actually masqueraded themselves under the use of naturism, which, for people who aren't familiar, is basically just like being a proponent of public nudity and thinking that it shouldn't be illegal and that it's perfectly moral and ethical because that's how we're supposed to be naturally out in the wilderness.
Oh, naturism.
Oh, is that what it is?
See, when you said naturism, I thought you were talking about like those people that when you say something and they agree with it, they look at you and go, natch.
What? I'm sorry, what?
Ignore me. Go ahead.
Oh, dear God. Oh, man. So anyway, yeah, these naturist magazines appeared as early as the late 1920s. The first one was Health and Efficiency magazine in Britain. H&E had some naturism articles and slowly started building up their softcore porn introduction. And everybody in Britain was just like completely taken aback. And they were like, this is crazy. But all the dudes were like, yeah, it's totally crazy. Hey, let me see that so I can go show somebody else. I can go show Robert how crazy this is.
Oh, Robert again.
My friend Robert. I gotta go show him. BRB. Anyway, yeah, so H&E magazine in Britain in the late 1920s, around the same time the U.S. got Tijuana Bibles, which were actually just like crudely drawn comic books. And those were like really hardcore. Like if you've ever actually seen any screen caps of Tijuana Bibles, some of them are just, whew. For a little while, there was a Tijuana comic book series that was like the like two presidents just like boning each other and making all sorts of really terrible like politics jokes and stuff. It was really weird.
Were they politics puns?
No.
Damn it.
Stop.
My porn needs to have pun.
Well, it gets better. Trust me.
Oh, okay.
Oh, man. So Tijuana Bibles, that was the U.S.'s first introduction to printed pornography. Then in the 1940s is when pinups started being introduced into magazines like Modern Man. And then like the first issue of Playboy was released in 1953. And Hugh Hefner himself is actually the one who coined the term centerfold, which was a reference to the center fold-out pinup in the magazines. And for those of you who don't know, the term pinup is actually a reference to the fact that these magazines would get sent to soldiers overseas and they would literally like rip out the pages and pin them up on their walls because they were a bunch of pervs, I guess.
Yeah, well, they were lonely and they were at war. They needed some morale boosting, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And also, Air Force or Army Air Corps airplanes at the time, like bombers and fighters, used to have pinup art painted on the noses.
I do recall that, actually.
Yeah, some of it is really badass. Like, if you look at it, you're like, holy shit, who painted that?
Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. Now, look, I am a fan of art, and I am not a good painter. And so when I see somebody who has painted, like, some just really, really good shit, then I'm like, I'm jealous.
Fair enough. So anyway, back to porn. At the same time that Modern Man and Playboy released, oh, actually not the same time, it was about 10 years afterward, France got a magazine called Louis, and the UK got Penthouse in 1965. And those were their first, like, softcore porn. They were no longer hiding under the guise of naturism. They were just like, okay, fine, here's some semi-naked females. And then the first quote-unquote hardcore pornography started to appear in Hustler in 1990. And this is where the kind of new standard was set. This is like more than one person, actual penetration being depicted, lesbian scenes starting to be introduced, a little bit of fetish stuff here and there.
Yeah, and right around 1995 or 6, so I'm told, Hustler actually started photographing cum shots.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. I remember reading something about that.
Yeah, I mean, somebody told me that.
Robert.
God damn it, Robert. Clear your freaking browser history.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's when things started to get a little grimier. And basically, people were just like trying to keep the interest sparked up and wanted to set the bar a little higher. And so that kind of became the new standard for things. And then obviously, with the mainstream introduction of the internet, magazines and other printed forms of porn started to fall off in popularity. And I mean, that was a slow, gradual, well, actually, I wouldn't say that it was necessarily slow. Like, once people started realizing they could put porn on the internet and access that porn from the internet, it started to skyrocket quite a bit.
Yeah, the only people who were still getting magazines were people who had the Playboy subscription and didn't realize that they hadn't canceled it.
Or their friend Robert just renewed it on accident.
God damn it, Robert!
So as a frame of reference, in the year 2014, throughout the entire year, Pornhub, the website, accrued over 78.9 billion views. On ad revenue alone, that means that the site earned over $100 million that year. Jeez. Just on ad revenue. And I'm fairly certain that was they've had their like premium subscription for a while now. So who knows how much ungodly amounts of money they made off of that, too.
Who's paying for porn?
All right, so that's the thing. This is one thing that actually, full disclosure, this is what prompted me talking about this week, was me, out of curiosity, wondering how, like, people in the porn industry actually make money, because, like, 90% of the porn that people watch is totally free and does not require any money to access at all. But that's the thing, is that if you think about, so I think the statistic was the average person provides at a minimum 18 page views to Pornhub when they go to the site. And that could be like flipping through, I don't know, a couple of different searches and like trying to settle on a video that they want to watch. I don't know. But 18 page views per person every time they visit the site. And if you think about that, each page that you visit has, I don't know, like 7 or 8 advertisements on it. And if you view 7 or 8 advertisements 18 times in the course of one sitting when you go to Pornhub.com, that's automatically a pretty substantial amount if you per person who goes to Pornhub every day. So, yeah, ad revenue alone makes Pornhub a shit ton of money. And then, I mean, there are always people out there who are going to be like, oh, I can have an elevated experience if I pay more money. Boom! I'm going to do it. Derp, 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 take my money. So it doesn't really matter what it is, porn or games or otherwise. People are just going to shell out money when they can.
Yeah, but I just don't understand paying money for 8 minutes.
I mean, I don't know. I'm sure that there's something more to it. Like, I think that a Brazzers subscription gets you unlimited access to all of their videos that they put out. And this is the thing, like, Pornhub is owned by MindGeek, which is a site, I think, that primarily handles advertisement, if I remember correctly. But basically, they just, like, absorbed all of these free porn tubes, and they've just been making a shit ton of money off of it now. Because, like, other porn companies that aren't free, for example, Brazzers or Reality Kings or things like that, they offer paid content, but what they'll do is license clips of their paid content to free sites like that, to MindGeek's like subsidiaries. They'll license clips of them out so that people can see like a little snapshot of what's in the video. And then if those people are so prompted, like some people will see a porn video and they'll just become enthralled with it and obsessed and will be like, oh my gosh, this is my favorite video ever. Every time I masturbate now, I'm going to watch this video. And if that is the kind of person that you're targeting, giving them a tiny clip of something and offering them the promise of more if they were to pay for it would be more than enough incentive for them to pay for it, because that's there. People like that exist out there.
All right.
So anyway, that is how porn companies make money. Ad revenue, the paid companies offer clips of their content and license it out to the free companies and then advertise on their site. And then those people in return go and spend money on the paid site for fucking whatever reason.
Right. But that's pretty smart.
Yeah, it is. And MindGeek is arguably one of the smartest companies around for making the move to absorb a ton of free porn sites. Anywho, the popularity of porn and pop culture are very nearly proportional. I think you probably have the stat on this. When it comes to Pornhub, we'll do reporting statistics every once in a while, and they'll talk about how the release of something in pop culture will spark an almost instantaneous like search spike for the content surrounding that particular thing in pop culture. Do you have any points on this one?
I will say that one of the things that is cracking me up is that one of the most popular searches on Pornhub in 2017 was Rick and Morty.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck?
It's pretty hilarious. Yeah. But yeah, like as things start to get put out in pop culture and people are like, hey, this is a really cool thing, then there are some people who are like, this would be a really, really cool thing if those people were naked and having sex. So instantaneously, everybody just like goes to Pornhub and searches for, and it's not just Pornhub, like Rule 34 exists for that exact reason. Like everybody makes everything into porn. So people are constantly trying to get porn of something that they like or something they appreciate. The amount of My Little Pony porn on the internet is fucking unfathomable. It blows my mind. But that's the thing. So as video games and animated movies and stuff started to get released, and with the advancement in animation and rendering software, people actually started taking the 3D models that game developers were releasing for public use for things like Source Filmmaker, SFM, like Gary's Mod, stuff like that, that people were like making funny little clips and stuff with. And people were taking those and making them into porn. And this actually caused a huge legal process from Blizzard. They prompted themselves to scour the internet and purge it of any pornographic SFM material using character models from Overwatch. And I think they still kind of are. Like, you can still find SFM porn of Overwatch characters, but it's, like, much, much smaller of a library now, because Blizzard was actually pretty successful in wiping the majority of it off of the internet.
And I feel like that's a losing battle.
Oh, for sure. And that's the funniest thing to me is that Blizzard is, specifically in Overwatch, pumping out all of these female characters who have fucking massive cleavage showing and accentuated curves all over the place. And they're like, damn, why do people keep making porn out of our game characters? I don't understand.
Yeah.
Anyway, on top of the spike in animated porn, there's also been a spike in fetish porn, which is spreading like wildfire. If you've been to a porn site in the past 2 years, you'll see just how popular faux-cest porn is becoming, which is just like porn acts between family members, step or otherwise. The popularity of incest porn has just skyrocketed in the past couple of years, and nobody's like super sure why, but right now Pornhub's reported top three search terms from millennials are, in order of usage, lesbian, teen, and stepmom. And that's just the world we live in now. People want to see stepmoms boning their stepsons, I guess.
It's the breakdown of the modern American family. It's women's lib is to blame.
Yeah, basically. Oedipus Rex has taken over. We need to stop teaching it in schools. Get it out of our classroom. No more incest.
You know what it is? It's because we kicked God out of our porn. And now it's just defiled.
Oh my god. It might actually be attributed to the rise in, like, the, I wouldn't say normalization, but just, like, things like Game of Thrones are starting to just, like, throw incest in there, like, at first for shock factor, but then they're just like, yeah, this is a part of our show now. There is incest. Get used to it.
That's true. But speaking of kicking God out of porn, I've noticed that nun porn isn't really all that big anymore.
Not anymore. It did used to be super, super popular.
Right.
Yeah, then people started realizing that when you introduce religious figures into porn, it gets a little too real. because that's not just pretend anymore. Like, that does happen, and it is sad.
Oh, Catholics.
So anyway. But yeah, so you've got your animated porn, you've got your fetish porn, and now, with the introduction of virtual reality, you have VR porn. And ever since VR was implemented on smartphones, virtual reality porn very quickly became a thing. And you can pretty much go out and get a 3D camera, or I don't know, whatever, 360-degree camera to record whatever you want to. But obviously, people started using those to record porn. And anybody with access to a VR headset and a smartphone can watch VR porn now. And on top of that, anybody who has a VR headset, like an actual, like an HTC Vive or an Oculus Rift, anything like that, there are actually indie game developers who are releasing room-scale hentai games for VR headsets that have basically, like, near full interactivity.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so you're just, like, walking around in a room full of naked monster chicks, and you can take your pick and bone them, if that's what you're into.
But not actually bone them. I still don't understand VR.
All right, I think we need to reassess VR on another show at some point, because clearly you just don't understand.
Oh, okay. So I feel like it's certainly true that some of our most important technological innovations and advances have come as a part of NASA programs.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like some of the biggest and most widely used innovations have come about because of porn.
I mean, you're not wrong. And at the very least, if not because of, then immediately adopted by.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, especially like when the internet first got released and people started using the internet to distribute pornography, it was just insane how quickly that took on. I couldn't find a ton of statistics for it. There are actually quite a few things that I couldn't find statistics for, because if you actually try to do any sort of research on the subject of pornography, having to incorporate the word pornography into your search term just gives you all sorts of results that are not helpful at all.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, I'd say that you're definitely not wrong. And especially on the subject of VR, like, there are actually, I would say, if you look at the database or the library of regular computer games or console games to computer games or console games that have a focus on sexuality or any sort of sexual themes, it's very, very slim, actually. There's not a whole lot of equality there, and for good reason, because game publishers don't want to put out a sex game because it makes it kind of look bad on them, I guess, which I think is kind of a silly argument. I think that if people are going to buy your game, it doesn't really matter if you want to, like, set up a, I don't know, some sort of third-party company and operate under the guise of them to publish your sex games. You're still going to make ass loads of money, probably more than any AAA title that gets released, because that's, like, anybody who has ever played, like, an online flash sex game, like, it's their dream to have a AAA developer like Blizzard or Activision publish a sex-based game. Like, they would just be swimming in money at that point, honestly.
Well, let's be honest. The games that are already being made with the character models for females are basically porn and sex games anyway. And I think that all of the backlash over the latest Tomb Raider movie and how everybody is just furious that Alicia Vikander doesn't have big enough boobs to be
Lara Croft.
Yeah, Lara Croft is proof of that.
Yeah, you're probably not wrong. Anyway, what I was trying to say is that the division between normal games for the VR and games that indie developers are specifically developing as sex games for VR is actually not too far off. The ratio is pretty close. And that's because I think VR is finally providing people with an open source platform to do pretty much whatever they want to. It's pretty interesting.
Well, okay then.
But yeah, there you have it. That is essentially the concise, dumbed down history of pornography.
So if you had to rate it on a scale of seeing your stepmom naked?
Personally, my stepmom naked? At least my actual old stepmom? That's a hard pass for me. But I'm going to put it higher than that on the list. If this is just a one boundary scale at this point, it is going to be as far away from that as humanly possible.
Yeah, it's an over-under.
All right, well, very much over. That is my response.
Okay, that's enough for this week. I've got a flying horse to catch. As always, we couldn't do this without the continued support of our amazing patrons: Gaytheist, Lisa McLean, Holly Vane, the Saratok Podcast, the Dumb All Over Podcast, Brothel Knight, Sojo, and Taro Tikkanen. Until next week, you can send us an email to podcast@waywardwillis.com. Intro music was provided by Austin Cologne and used with permission. You can find more of Austin's music linked in the show notes. This podcast is a media production of Willisware LLC. All rights reserved.
This has been The Wayward Willis. If you liked what you just heard and you want more of John and Logan, you can follow us on Twitter @WaywardWillis, Facebook @facebook.com/TheWaywardWillis, or at WillisWeb.com. If you want to help the show and have a few extra dollars, you can donate per episode or per month on Patreon at patreon.com/wayward. We'll be back next week.